and welcome to the On Iowa Politics podcast for Friday, May 9th, 2014. I'm Mike Weiser, State House Bureau Chief for Lee Enterprises. Today we're going to talk about the Senate campaign getting heated, what's next for the Oversight Committee, and reading the polls. With me to discuss those topics are Todd Dorman, political writer for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Hello, Todd.
Hey, Mike.
Christina Crippis, political writer for the Waterloo Courier. Hello, Christina.
Hello, good morning.
And Ed Tibbetts, political writer from the Quad City Times. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Mike. Hi, everybody.
You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to On Iowa Politics on iTunes. First up, with less than a month to go before the June primary race for the GOP nomination, is getting mean. Retired business executive Mark Jacobs and State Senator Joni Ernst are at the top of the polls in the five-way contest. There's been bickering amongst the campaigns. Jacobs called Ernst AWOL for missing Senate votes. Ernst shot back that she was never absent without leave and even had 2008 GOP presidential nominee John McCain chime in on her side. And some advocacy groups have gotten in on the action. Jacobs responded to the latter with a TV ad that I saw airing in the Des Moines Metro market this week. It begins like this.
Negative ads from out-of-state groups like the one attacking me? Or what's wrong with politics? It's sort of like that bully who throw rocks at you from behind the fence.
Meanwhile, we're not hearing much from the other candidates, save for maybe Matt Whitaker, who announced in an editorial that ran in the Cedar Rapids Gazette that he is against the renewable fuel standards, which, as you know, is the guaranteed market for biofuels. Todd Dorman, are you surprised that the race is taking the turn that it has?
No, I mean, it's almost voting time, so of course folks are going to start sharpening their elbows and trying to make some room for themselves. It does seem like Joni Ernst and Mark Jacobs are the two candidates that have put a little space between them and the other, and Matt Whitaker and Sam Clovis. It was interesting how Jacobs seemed to sort of fumble the attack on the AWOL video on his website or the website that he put up. It's a fair criticism that Joni Ernst has missed several votes, some of which have been due to her military service, but a lot of them because she's out campaigning. And I think, you know, that's, voters are always sensitive to the idea of not doing your duty if you're in elected office. So, but it backfired on him. I guess it's the old military training where if you're going to attack, you know, make sure to not throw the pin and keep the grenade. So he sort of fumbled that one. But I think she's in a good position. Her ads recently have gotten a lot of attention. Obviously, she's got the new one where she rides in on the Harley and the leather jacket and blows away Obamacare. And then she has a good shot. So good for her. But we'll see what happens. We'll see if Whitaker's splash makes any difference on the renewable fuel standard. Most of the reaction I've seen so far has been from the renewable fuels industry, and obviously it's not entirely positive. But there is a certain segment of the Republican electorate that will like what he has to say about, you know, getting big government out of our consumer choices and letting the market work.
You know, Mike, what surprised me about this is that at this late stage in the race, with all the back and forth between Ernst and Jacobs, that Mark Jacobs hasn't used his considerable financial resources to go harder after Ernst. Now, I suspect that might be coming. The ad that you mentioned alluded to her, obviously, but I suspect that they're going to soon be more direct about this. I'm just a little surprised they haven't done it earlier.
Well, and he didn't really even attack her. He attacked the groups that are sort of that were attacking him, throwing the rocks over the fence, I guess is what he said. So yeah, at some point you'd think that he's going to have television ads that attack her directly by name.
Yeah, and I wanted to mention, you and I are going to be panelists on a debate a week from this Monday with these five candidates, or at least the five candidates have accepted. This might be the last major debate out in eastern Iowa before the primary. Do you think that some of this bad blood is going to be evident on the stage? Or from what I've seen so far, the attacks have been really done through advertisements in third person, and they haven't really gone after each other when in place. What's your thought on this?
Well, I think that when you're going after another candidate, you're probably going to want to do it on your terms. So a TV ad is probably, and simply by virtue of exposure, the more efficient way to go about it. you're right. So far in the debates, they have not gone after one another, and I think that surprised some folks. Whether it'll happen at this particular one, you know, I don't really know, but I think Todd made the point earlier. The later it gets, the sharper the elbows get.
You're right. Next up, the Oversight Committee. We didn't get into this too much last week, but the last official action of the 85th General Assembly was a resolution by the Iowa Senate to allow the Senate Oversight Committee the power to subpoena state workers in their ongoing investigation of the confidential settlement payments scandal, I guess. Governor Terry Branstad said he found it, quote, curious that the Senate did this and intimated that it has much more to do with Democratic Senator Jack Hatch's gubernatorial campaign than any quest for information by the Senate. Hatch says there's no coordination between the campaign and the Oversight Committee. Christina, can anyone here claim the high ground?
You know, I think a lot will probably depend on what happens with the investigation going forward. If there's fire where the Democrats are currently seeing smoke, I think that their continued efforts on this is going to are going to seem warranted, and the governor's kind of poo-pooing the issue will kind of seem poor judgment. But if nothing nefarious turns up or there's no one that they can really identify as the person who authorized these confidential agreements, I think it'll probably come across as playing politics, whether or not their intentions were to do that or not. I think it's interesting that I guess the other thing I'd say is it's interesting that they waited to do this until the day after the House had adjourned for the session. I wasn't there, so maybe you or someone else will have a better insight into this, but I found it interesting that they did it on the next morning, but they didn't even really discuss it. They just waited till the next morning, talked in caucus for a little bit, came back, voted on it, and then were done. And I found that interesting.
Yeah, I can tell you, I was there that night, and it looked like, I'm telling people, look, the Senate chambers, you know, this was, we had been there from about 8:30 on Wednesday through about 8:30 on Thursday overnight. People were, it looked like there had been a gas attack or something, because you'd walk into the chamber and people were, senators and staff were just asleep in their chairs and passed out. It was quite a surreal scene. As you said, they did adjourn after they did one final budget bill. They came back. I think that was more towards, the explanation I heard is they just wanted to make sure that they had everybody there and everybody aware and awake for what they were doing, and they wanted to make sure they had all 26 there. So I think it was more of a procedural thing than not, but perhaps there's a reason I have not been able to divine yet. You know, Todd, I was wondering, is this... you've written eloquently on the oversight committees. Is this something that's still holding your interest, or is this something that seems like it's already run its course?
Well, I think there are still some questions to answer about several aspects of this. In particular, I think the veterans home situation, keeping the commandant long after folks had made some pretty serious charges against him. I think that's probably, of all these things, that may be the one that strikes the loudest chord with voters in the long run. But, you know, I think these things always run on two tracks. There's the track where they're trying to figure out what's going on, which, you know, I'm most interested in. But then, of course, there's the political track. And having the subpoena power and holding these hearings keeps this story in the news. It keeps reporters coming to cover the meetings, and so it doesn't let it die over the summer, which it would have if they weren't meeting. So, yeah, I mean, there's no coordination with the Hatch campaign, maybe formally, but you know, it's obvious that Democrats are interested in denting Branstad up before the November election.
Excellent. And speaking of Branstad and the November election, another set of polling came out this week looking at likely voters and definite voters in the gubernatorial election. The likely voters gave incumbent Republican Terry Branstad a 10-point edge, while definite voters gave him a 3-point edge. The Branstad campaign trumpeted the former result, and the Hatch campaign the latter. Ed Tibbetts, is either number more legitimate right now?
Well, that's kind of the key question, isn't it? What the electorate's going to look like, and it's one of the toughest parts of polling, figuring out whether your sample is representative. We've got several months to go before Election Day, and what's really at work right now, I think, is that Democrats are trying to counter the image that Branstad is coasting for to win. Perception can be reality, and you know, when you've got a governor who's got a big fundraising lead and some pundits and even some in your own party wondering whether you've got a chance at winning, you need to blunt that perception. And some of these polls, I think, have helped to do that. You had a poll from a Democratic firm that showed among likely voters that that Branstad was only up by 5. Then you had a poll from a Republican firm that had Branstad up by 15. This one is sort of just right, if you want to use the Goldilocks analogy. It's somewhat in the middle among likely voters. The Branstad people like having a double-digit lead, and the Hatch people are trying to accentuate this number among definite voters, and more to the point, the trend that seems to show a more competitive race.
It strikes me, and Christine, I'm wondering what you think about this. It strikes me that Jack Hatch is trumpeting, you know, that he's close within single digits, but really that still puts him in second place. Does he need an issue to grab on to get over this last thing? What does he need so he can so these poll numbers show him close? Or is it, as Ed had said, just the idea that Branstad is inevitable, just keeping people away from him right now?
I think there's probably a couple things at play. I mean, I think you're right that he needs an issue or he needs something that he can kind of stand out on. I think, you know, hardcore Democrats really are already supporting him, but that's not going to get your average person to be paying attention to what he's saying or what he's doing to get any traction. And like you said, especially as at this point, it still kind of seems inevitable that the incumbent is going to win. It seems like it's probably a good Republican year, and it seems like Branstad has been popular for decades in the state, so it's a tough battle for him to overcome. I guess the other thing I'd say is that just with the primary election being a little bit less than a month away here, about 3 weeks out, I don't feel like a lot of voters are maybe paying as much attention to this race when there are so many open seat races and so many contested primaries. We talked about the U.S. Senate race, but the first and third and second district all have some sort of primary race going where people are probably not keeping their eye on the general election quite yet. So I think that probably is also going to be at play after the primary. I think if Hatch finds an issue that he can latch onto, that might make those polls a little bit closer and might help him see or make the governor seem a little bit less inevitable.
I think one of Hatch's best issues is one that the governor can't do much about, and that's just sort of the notion that nobody should be governor this long or that he's been governor for too long. And, I mean, this could be a good Republican year. All signs point that way. But within that is also sort of an anti-incumbency streak in a midterm where you have sort of the electorate go against the president's party, and because they don't like the way things are going, people say that, you know, the wrong track numbers are bad nationally. I think there will be an anti-incumbency streak in that, and that could, you know, maybe hurt Branstad if Hatch can actually make that case that he's been governor too long and that nobody should have that power for that long, and it's led to the sort of things that we've seen the last several weeks. And if he can connect those dots, that might actually be a fairly powerful argument.
Excellent point. And that's it for today's On Iowa Politics podcast. I hope it was worth your time. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, tell a friend and subscribe to us on iTunes. It'll help more people find the podcast. You can find us every week on the homepages of the Quad City Times, Sioux City Journal, Muscatine Journal, Mason City Globe Gazette, Waterloo Courier, and the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Item 9 in the Mad Hatters from Cedar Rapids will take us out. If you aren't a band or know a talented Iowa musician who should be on our show, drop us a line, or better yet, a sound file. And remember to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on iTunes. For Ed, Christinia, Todd, and producer Max, I'm Mike Weiser. Thanks for listening. I'm out of here.
some ladies.